Hello, I'm Luke Clancy, and you're welcome to the most November 22nd, 2019 edition yet of the Culture File Weekly, with all the best of this week's daily culture files, including tales of datafication down on the farm with Professor Aisling Kelleher, news of women composers no longer overlooked at the National Concert Hall in Dublin, the life-altering power of free improvised music with Paul G. Smith, and the resurrection of Zandra, Queen of Jazz, an Irish jazz sax player whose heyday was in 1930s Berlin, back to life now in a new stage show. But it's with the philosophy of the piano we get started this time. Paul G. Smith is probably Ireland's most prominent free improviser, a regular collaborator with world figures such as saxophonist Avon Parker and this week in Dublin, multi-instrumentalist and composer Ned Rothenberg. Culturefile spoke to Smith a little while ago in the resonant space of Dublin's Luther House. Unavoidably, too much of that fascinating conversation hit the cutting room floor. So this time we're going to have a second bite of the cherry. But first, a little heavy lifting.
So your piano is tucked away in the corner for the moment. We need to deal with that.
Well, by almost slipping a disc.
Glad these things are on wheels.
Although I have played this one without putting the brakes on it and ended up in a different place in the room by the end of the evening than I started it. Which can make drummers quite nervous when you start, you know, it's like the tide coming in. It's like a large, you know, six and a half foot wooden tide.
You do have this thing with Evan Parker and Derek Bailey as well, where there's almost a moral quality to producing something that wasn't there before, that it isn't a repetition and that combination didn't have happened before.
Yeah, and that's a lot of the attraction of the process for me. I think, particularly as you know, growing up as an Irish Catholic, you know, with a faith that spends a lot of its time regretting the past and with promises of a better future, it's a rare thing to be pulled into the present tense and to stay there for any length of time. You're alive now. Stop deliberating over your past or worrying about your future, or you're here now. There's a place for, you know, popular music. There's a place for contemporary music. It depends on what you need out of it. For me, improvised music, when I discovered it as a listener, it felt like a sort of a homecoming, really, because here was a music that was as messy and complex and at the same time very as direct and unadorned as the world around me, that the world that I could see, you know, with all its flaws.
Your stance over the piano, it's like a drummer there.
My mother would be devastated, be like, stand up straight. Yeah. I found one of my first sort of end of year exam reports for College of Music, and I think the first comment on it was, please sit up straight, followed by maybe four exclamation marks. So I'm delighted to say that that situation hasn't really changed or improved. Well, my own background had been classical music, and as a teenager then, thanks to stealing my entire family's library cards for the ILAC Centre, raiding their, you know, their tapes and their LPs, it was a mix of classical music, contemporary music and jazz.
Like, what was the ILAC library's collection of improvised music like at the time?
Surprisingly good. I stumbled across solo records by Evan Parker, pianist Howard Riley, all stuff that as a teenager I thought was horrible, completely horrible. I didn't think human beings were the target audience at all for this stuff. But something stuck you know, years went by, I thought, God, I must dig that out again. And when I returned to it, what had been alien to me had felt very familiar. And I think that's an interesting change there. I don't know, I guess people change and their relationships to art or music shift constantly, you know.
So if you were going to sit down there, I mean, like, you usually wouldn't do this, but would you kind of talk to me about what's going on in your head? You put your hand into the strings of the piano there to begin with, and you're looking inside.
The instrument has more to it than just black and white keys. There's a huge range in terms of palette, from strings to, I mean, it, you know, the piano is a percussion instrument. There are other ways of striking these strings, you know.
You're not practicing for it in any sense, other than everything you do is somehow practicing for it. You're going to, on the night, create something from nothing.
I am, but I have a feeling that it's ultimately the same piece, and I'm just tapping in and out of it a couple of times a year. It moves on when I'm not playing, and when I dip back into it again, it's at a different place. Perhaps because my life has changed accordingly. You know, the language is roughly the same in that I'm not trying to reinvent myself every time I sit down at the piano. I have my vocabulary and, like everyone else, my limitations, you know, and tendencies, I suppose. So while it is completely improvised, there are certain ways it tends to go. You know, I can surprise myself completely as well, you know, go into a room thinking it'll have one shape and turns out it makes another decision for me.
I don't know how on earth people record you.
How or why?
Paul G. Smith there, and his latest album, Calenture and Light Leaks, a duo album with Evan Parker, is out now. Now, from free improvisation to precision farming. The farm is hardly the first location to fall to the latest wave of automation and datafication, but could it be the aptest place yet for some upgrades? Possibly, says our regular tech soothsayer, Professor Aisling Kelleher, with a few caveats.
Farming, has always been about precision and crop yield and knowing how much milk each particular cow gives. And I think, you know, because the margins are so thin on that, farmers have for generations been using as much kind of data that they could collect from the natural environment to help them make decisions. Since the 1980s, drone technology, or kind of what has become a drone, other types of unmanned aerial vehicles, have been used to kind of plot and understand land use. And that's been going on. I think farmers have really kind of leapt on any of these technological innovations, everything from, obviously, from the first tractors came along, but to what you're seeing now with trying to make sense not only of the data that they can collect, but big data in general. And I think we're seeing some really tremendous innovations here that are going to be really necessary in quite turbulent times ahead. If we're projected to have a population of 9 billion by 2050, the assumption is that we're going to have to grow our agricultural output by about 70%. So given the amount of land and the scarcity of water and climate change, there's definitely a huge pressure on to begin to ensure the efficiency and the sustainability of the agricultural field.
Some of these innovations are really about just farming more sensibly. I mean, one of the big robotic devices is a weeding machine, which you think, well, that's very handy, it's about employment. But in fact, it's a kind of much more sustainable approach to tilling a field.
Yeah, I mean, the Farmwise are one of the big companies that have created these huge weeding machines as a service. Okay, they're so astronomically expensive. The idea is that a farmer themselves wouldn't have this, but they would rent it and the team itself would kind of put it to use in your field. What's interesting is because traditional ways of tillage or ploughing, it disturbs the soil, okay? So it denigrates the soil over time, but it also releases a lot of CO2 and then people start using as an alternative herbicides. But the idea with this, the kind of the growth in no-till farming, which is good, but it means more herbicide, is to come up with this idea of going back to the old-fashioned way, but of doing it at scale with a giant machine. So really what this can do is it's using computer vision and machine learning so the machine can distinguish between a weed and a something that's part of your crop. So this idea is that it's not going to be as harmful as tillage or ploughing, and it will greatly reduce the amount of herbicide or pesticide that people need to use. You begin to see some interesting machines that have been developed to try and get at the human labor shortage problem. There's a company called Rubion who've created this robot that it sounds like it's such a niche area that it picks strawberries, but it's very, very clever in how it goes about doing that. It's able to tell whether the strawberry is, what stage of ripeness it is. So it's kind of like a just-in-time picker, and it has this very gentle little hand. 3D printed hand that will pluck the strawberry. And some of their other innovations are very clever. Again, if we're thinking about trying to do something that's more sustainable, that uses less chemicals, they're using deep ultraviolet light as a kind of a way to deal with mildew on strawberries. And it can tell whether or not they have mildew on them and then treat it with ultraviolet light.
Another company is offering a kind of a fleet of drones for hire that will put your fields under observation.
I'm very excited about the drone fleets. I think this would look wonderful. I'm sure my uncles down in West Clare would think this is great on the farm. But one of the things I really like, there's a couple of startups that are not just using drones for surveillance, they're also using them for planting. So you can load up the drones with these pods that have both the seeds and the nutrients in them, and you shoot them into the soil. That sounds very kind of Star Wars-y, but there's something rather exciting about the idea of having, you know, you're the farmer with your awesome simulator thing back at the house, and you, like, launch off all these drones that shoot stuff in, and then the next fleet of drones goes out the following week to see where they are. Because of the aging of the farming population as well, this is not necessarily that all these machines are going to replace farmers. In some ways, it's to make them more efficient and also to reduce accidents as well and kind of the hazardous things that they might have to do.
This is a problem that's been pointed out in America, and I guess we have a version of it here, in that the people who are working on the farms, the profile is aging, and therefore physically they're not as strong as young field workers.
Yeah, I mean, the farming population is definitely aging. Even within the United States, the average age is about 58, and it's projected in about 10 or 12 years probably to be up around 65, which I would imagine is kind of a global thing that's happening also. I mean, farming is a really hard life, you know, and so the idea that this intergenerational attraction to it might not just have the same pull that it used to have. So, yes, the farmers are getting older, they're having to kind of do more with their bodies. So I think we're also seeing wonderful innovations for exoskeletons or the types of things that you might imagine an Iron Man wearing. But these are things that originally developed primarily for the military, but they have tremendous use as well in the types of physical labor that farmers are doing, everything from lifting to shoveling, even just getting in and out of tractors, or the kind of the fatigue on your body from sitting in a tractor for like 8 or 9 or 12 hours a day.
Tell us what an exoskeleton is.
An exoskeleton is essentially like an apparatus that you can construct around your body that you can control either with a remote control or with different types of buttons. So in a sense, it kind of will leverage for you so that you're able to lift much heavier things using a kind of a mechanical structure that is mounted around you. I mean, they're used in the military to facilitate soldiers using being able to carry very large and heavy gear with them. And they generally will help with the kind of the day-to-day things like lifting is a big one. And that's something that we're also seeing as being looked at in Amazon or any of these kind of big warehouses where people are doing repetitive movements that can be quite damaging on your back. Creating and kind of sculpting the body into an exoskeleton, which doesn't have to be hard. There are also soft exoskeletons as well. And Connor Walsh at Harvard. He's a fellow dub. He's doing some really wonderful work there in developing a whole manner of exoskeletons that are both for people who are able-bodied and also others who are kind of working around disabilities. One of the reasons why this technology is interesting for some folks is that there is, particularly where I live here in rural Virginia, there is the sense that they're trying to keep populations in kind of rural areas. And one way is this type of technology does appeal to younger potential farmers as well, to think about you could actually, not maybe you could be a part-time farmer because the other, you know, part of your farm is like fairly much semi-automated or even automated in full. And it might be more attractive to folks to begin to think about the types of skills that they have that could be practiced in a farming environment are also scalable and generalizable to other technology contexts. So this idea of being able to control drones, for example, or to be able to manipulate really large amounts of data sets in order to kind of innovate and come up with more and interesting ways to use your land sustainably, use your land efficiently.
Professor Aisling Kelleher there at her desk in Virginia Tech. Now, Resound is the title of the current season of music by women composers at the National Concert Hall in Dublin. It's been organised in collaboration with the Sounding the Feminist Collective, a voluntary group dedicated to promoting the creative work of women in music. There's a long history of suppressed and ignored music to work with, and Resound is just one part of a five-year project to right the historical wrongs. Culturefile's Áine Gallagher went to the National Concert Hall to meet pianist Una Hunt and others on the team writing the new rules.
All of these constraints were on women, and certainly, yes, women could study certain instruments, but they could not study composition because it was not considered the right thing, and they certainly shouldn't be composing any large-scale works.
Despite the fact that they have been excluded from concerts and from recording as well, women have actually been pretty active throughout the centuries. And this is one of the things that the series wants to show.
There are an awful lot of composers who were highly regarded at the time and then slip out of the repertoire sometimes. So it's great to shine a light on that, not just because they're female, but actually here's music that's really worth hearing in its own right. I'm Simon Taylor, I'm Chief Executive at the National Concert Hall, and we're delighted to be working with Sounding the Feminists on this initiative for female composers. It's interesting, you know, you'll get some people who will say we shouldn't be doing a female composer series because it's actually, in a way, almost drawing attention to that and to the fact that somehow female composers are in a different subcategory, if you like. And there's some validity in that, but I think in order to make that change, perhaps you do need to draw attention to the fact, in this case, that, you know, there has always been a female voice in music. A lot of it is really worth hearing and being brought into the repertoire, and maybe you need to make that sort of positive intervention in the first instance. And then hopefully the works that we're hearing across this series start to make their way into the standard repertoire.
Sounding the Feminist is a volunteer group who campaign for gender equality in music across Ireland. My name is Laura Watson, and I have been involved with Sounding the Feminist since it was established in 2017. If you listen to music on the radio and you're like listening to popular music and so on, you would get a sense there are so many prominent female singers and performers and songwriters. But in classical music, due to how the tradition developed centuries ago, there was this legacy of women being excluded. Women were only encouraged to make music in the home, or if they composed at all, it was supposed to be very simple, light music. So that's had a knock-on effect for women who are still trying to make it in classical music today.
My name is Una Hunt. I'm going to be performing on the 23rd of January in the Women's Composers series. There's about three themes in the programme, not just one. The first one is really France meets Ireland, where we have composers from France, but also composers who have a sort of a Franco-Irish connection. With a composer such as Shami Nad, I mean, she was quite an extraordinary composer because she had quite a lot of success, especially in America, both as a pianist but also as a composer. She, unfortunately, in her large-scale works, was criticised for being unfeminine. And in the small scale works, they were criticized because they were too small scale and too frothy and silly and not important enough. So, in other words, she couldn't really win. I hate to say that they're influenced by other composers, but certainly Melanie Boney's music. I'm playing a piece on the piano called La Cathédrale Blessée, which is very similar to Debussy's Cathédrale Engloutie. I feel it was very much influenced by that. I hate to say that, really, but since we don't know their music, we have to use the guideline of male composers, if you like, as to what their music sounds like. It's very impressionistic, it's very ethereal, it captures a mood and that type of thing. It's very beautiful music.
Let's say someone wants to explore this music. How do you go about it? I mean, where's the catalogue?
Well, that's the problem. There very often isn't a catalogue. I think, though, that female composers have become quite trendy, if you know what I mean, now, and their music is being published again in modern publications. But generally speaking, I mean, for instance, most of the work that I do is for Irish composers, and most of their music is not published, or at least it was published maybe 200 years ago or 150 years ago. It's not now available.
In the late 19th century, you have that very conscious emergence of female composers. You know, people like Ethel Smythe, for instance, who, you know, very definitely part of that whole suffragette sort of thing, very consciously going out there as a female voice in music. Ruth Crawford Seeger going into the 20th century, again, very consciously female composers. And I think now the situation we'd like to get to, I suppose, is where the gender is not relevant. And that should be the case. I mean, rather like we now talk about genre in music being less relevant, you know, is something classical music? Is it popular music? Is it jazz? In a way, as the old cliche goes, it's good music and bad music. And hopefully we'll get to a situation where actually the gender of the composer is not the relevant or important thing. It's the quality of the music that's produced.
Una Hunt there, ending that report from Áine Gallagher. Resound continues at the NCH until March, and on January 23rd, Sharon Carty and Una Hunt present pieces by French female composers. NCH.ie for all the details. And finally, on this week's Culturefile Weekly, a cultural full circle with the story of Dubliner Josephine Alexandra Zandra Mitchell. Mitchell was a groundbreaking musician in the 1920s, one of the few women saxophonists on the circuit. Her story was told in 2015 in a lyric feature documentary on this very station. And when our guest, writer, actor and saxophonist Roxanne Lynch heard that documentary, it set her off on the path that leads to tonight's Dublin premiere of a new show about Zandra, her life and music. So it seemed only reasonable to complete the circle and invite Roxanne Lynch to Culturefile Towers.
I had just started playing the saxophone again, and I just wanted to see what kind of musicians there were out there to listen to. So I googled female saxophone Ireland, and I found this Lyric FM documentary by Mark McMenamin about Josephine Alexandra Mitchell, the first female saxophonist in Ireland.
Jazz singer, saxophonist and bandleader Josephine Alexandra Mitchell, otherwise known as Zandra.
So I listened to it because I'd never heard of her, and her story was just so extraordinary that I couldn't believe that I hadn't heard of her before, and my imagination just went absolutely wild.
This is Michael Gallagher.
This is Zandra's tenor Mark. I had to buy a flight case for it because the case disintegrated with dampness and age.
She's from Phibsborough in Dublin, and she was born in 1903. She was from this incredibly musical family. Her father was a conductor at the Theatre Royal in Dublin, and her mother was an excellent pianist. Her mother, her father, and two uncles were known as the Cremona String Band, and they used to tour around Ireland playing everywhere. she just had this burning desire to play jazz instead of classical music. And then she got her chance because Eddie, her brother, had a band who were going to play in London. And he persuaded their parents somehow to let Zandra go with him because she would be such a novelty as a girl playing the saxophone that they'd be a sensation. And she was spotted by a band over there and they invited her off on tour.
Dear Miss Mitchell, do you wish to join us in London October 21st? I will pay you £7 per week in your fare from Paris. The band will be 16
and
girls.
Off she went. That was it. She toured all through the 1920s and she ended up settling in Berlin because she just loved it there and it was quite an exciting place at that time. And after World War I, it seemed like everyone was just partying and there were really exciting things going on musically, and she was playing with some of the greatest musicians of the 20th century. Like, she was at the same club as Django Reinhardt. She knew Coleman Hawkins and Joe Venuti, and she was just meeting these people on her travels and playing with them. I suppose the darker part of her story would have come in the rise of the Nazi Party and the build-up to World War II. I think it was when she settled in Berlin that she set up her own group. And her band was called Baby Mitchell's Queens of Jazz. And they did tour, but the address on their notepaper was in Berlin. So I think that was their base, and then they travelled from there. She lived the age of 92. She died in 1995. Her life definitely got quieter and quieter, I think, as she grew older. And war is traumatic. And, like, living in such a precarious situation where you know, someone might walk into your club and find you playing the wrong piece at the wrong time and that's it. You know, the uncertainty of her life for so long. I do think it must have taken a while to recover from that. It's been quite a long-ish process. It's been 2 and a bit years since I first put pen to paper, and it's gone through so many phases. I've tried to base it as much as I can on the sense of her that I got from how she would laugh, and I've tried to put as much of that, like, to try and get as much of the soul of those interviews into the play as I can. It was really important to me that she was the person telling her own story, that she was kind of seizing the stage and saying, let me tell you what happened.
Roxanne Lynch there, and Diane Skippy's production of Zandra, Queen of Jazz at Smock Alley Theatre is now returns only for this run, but on December 6th and 7th, Zandra is at the studio at the DLR Lexicon in Dunleary. And that brings to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back with more unexpected revivals next Friday at 7. Till then, bye now.